We had basketball talk with Mark Deeks. We had baseball talk with Matthew Trueblood and some various and sundry other conversations as well, celebrating the drunken creature that is Alex Ovechkin and everything that he is doing. The celebration is ongoing. He's almost like a sort of a benevolent version of Kaner.
Have we seen anyone else with the cup?
I don't know if he's given it to anyone else yet.
Customarily, you're supposed to pass that thing along. You don't just hog it all for yourself.
You brought it out of my cold, dead hands.
Apparently. My word.
And I use that line with that accent for increasing reason every day.
Apparently, yeah. So this is a story from the Indian Express, and I promise you we will not learn anything about cricket.
Holy heck!
As is my lifelong dream to not learn anything about cricket, but still appreciate the hell out of it. I just don't want to understand it. A recent tweet of former Pakistani cricketer Shahid Afridi, which, by the way, I think it should be not cricketer. I think it should be cricketeer. I think if you play cricket, you should be a cricketer.
I think you are. I think that's acceptable.
It's entirely pop. Remember, I'm trying to learn nothing about cricket.
I believe, but that you're not learning about cricket.
That's true. We are on the margins of cricket knowledge here.
I believe cricketer is acceptable.
Okay. Well, then I'm going to begin calling them cricketers.
Are you a rocketer or a rocketeer?
You are a rocket. If I learned anything from being alive in the early 90s, the Rocketeer. It's a fantastic movie. Also, Errol Flynn, kind of a Nazi, apparently. That's what I learned from that. Because the bad guy is based on Errol Flynn, which I subsequently found out as a young kid that Errol Flynn was kind of a Nazi.
So we've learned about papaya juice, chimchurri sauce, and not cricket. And the leanings of Errol Flynn.
Very importantly, we have not learned about cricket. Anyway, Shahid Afridi, who is a cricketer, was tweeting out some pictures of what he was doing in the off season, I guess, and he's got a picture of himself like feeding a deer with a bottle, and then he tweeted out a photo of his daughter, and in the background is a chained up lion.
What?
A chained up? He's got a lion in the house, chained up to a cage, and his daughter, I don't know, 6, 7 years old, something like that. It's just kind of wandering around. Obviously, this was met with a lot of rage on the internet because that's the only emotion you can meet things with on the internet is rage.
But it's
the only thing you're allowed.
Have a lion.
First of all, it's probably a bad idea. Secondly, it's likely illegal. Thirdly, it's whether it's chained up or not, a lion, and that's a small child. I don't know anything about cricket. Or cricketeering.
And we know no further about cricketeering.
Nor will I endeavor to find anything out about cricket or cricketeering. But this is likely a bad idea from Shahid Afridi, who has been blown up on the internet about this.
You are kidding!
Kid you not.
A foul pop off the bat of a Yankee was dropping right by the bullpen mound in Tampa. First baseman Jake Bowers gave chase toward the back of the bullpen mound. Right fielder Carlos Gomez gave chase, racing toward the back of the bullpen mound. Both players slid in that sort of dive slidey catch way. Not as if you're sliding into a base, just sort of both went hard feet first.
Right.
They executed a near-perfect, idealized scissor collision.
Yes, they did. It is not idealized.
No, we are talking like bullseye, junk on junk, pubic bone to pubic bone, perfect angle, perfect everything. They could have run at each other and attempted to do this as part of a trapeze act multiple times.
The Walensky's could not have done this.
They could not. The Walendas?
The Walensky's.
Did they write the Guinness Book of World Records?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So whatever they watch it at your peril. Or watch it with the sound on at your peril.
The sound is horrifying.
Yes, this idea of you turn on a baseball game and you always see something you've never seen before. You never want to see this again.
And their faces. Yeah,
because both of them are wondering if they've been rendered sexless after this.
And do guys still, I know some guys are still wearing protection, still wearing cups. Not everybody, though. Not everybody.
Very few.
I can't. I don't think catchers. Outfielders. Catchers do. If you're on the corner, maybe third or first, maybe. Mm-hmm. Third, I think a lot of guys still wear it. Outfielders, no. First baseman, maybe?
I don't think so. Yeah. I thought that was just kind of out, but this is, ouch.
The University of North Carolina has gotten a commitment from a player whose name I'd like to hear quite a bit on Saturdays. I hope it happens. This from 24/7 Sports, the Inside North Carolina blog.
It's not Kobe Buffalo meat.
It's better. After
better than Kobe Buffalo meat?
It's up there. It's up there. It's really up. I love this one. After camping at North Carolina on Saturday, Storm Duck verbally committed to the Tar Heels. "It made me feel like I'm wanted there," Duck told Inside North Carolina shortly after making the commitment. "Coach Thigpen has been recruiting me, and I got to meet Coach Baker on Saturday. The whole staff made me feel wanted there. I liked how big they are on business, and that's what I want to major in, and I just feel strongly about the school." He is a 6-foot, 187-pound defensive back from Bowling Springs, South Carolina. He shunned an offer from West Virginia, and Storm Duck will be a
spelled Storm Duck?
Storm Duck, just the way you want to see it.
So when Mr. and Mrs. Duck were there in the delivery room, and they came out and said, "It's a boy."
Well,
said,
that's Storm, if I've ever seen one.
Storm has arrived. I want to thank Twitter friend Adam for sending the video, the GIF of the scene in Blades of Glory when John Heater and Will Ferrell also execute the perfect. That's what it was, except more violent. I mean, yes, you've got to see it to believe it, but indeed, that is really what it is. So,
oh man.
I'll do the baseball story next. This comes to you from the Independent Canadian American Association. The pitcher for the New Jersey Jackals was Matt Latos.
Of course it was.
He sparked a massive brawl when he threw over the head of an opposing batter. Then Latos' catcher was run over at the plate on the previous play because he wasn't happy about it. He goes inside with the first pitch over the batter's head with the second pitch. There's a flying clothesline that's executed as part of this independent league brawl.
Good Lord.
And when I mentioned this to Connor, Connor's like, oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Of course it's Matt Latos. I have two stories about Matt Latos, and both of them are okay. Matt Latos has on his big guy, right? Big guy. He's got a lot of tattoos. He was nice enough to talk to you, but Matt Latos, nothing was ever Matt Latos' fault. Matt Latos has a calf-sized tattoo of Brian from Family Guy. And I just, after seeing it, okay. I thought to myself, one thing and one thing only. What does that cartoon have to mean to you? That you're getting a calf-sized tattoo of Brian from Family Guy, Brian, emblazoned on your leg.
It's the anthropomorphic dog.
The yes. dog. Why is that so important to you? And I never got the answer. I never got an answer at all about that tattoo, but he has that tattoo there on what I think is left calf, I think it is. The other one is this. He was in spring training, right? And he's throwing against the Giants. It's Matt Latos and Jake Peavy starting a spring training game. So already the amount of stuff out on that mound is pretty high. And both of them, this is as Peavy's trying to get back, you know, and he's just gruff and yelling and screaming. And Latos is doing the same thing. It was just before he rattled off like six really strong starts for the White Sox that you knew wasn't going to support itself because every ground ball that got hit was getting turned into an out for Matt Latos. So you knew it was just kind of fool's gold. So he's throwing and he's just all over the place, completely wild. And after every pitch, he's looking down at the mound and screaming at the mound and just kicking at it and the whole thing. And the grounds crew comes out and they redo it. They're just all angry. And this is a guy who clearly knows he's not, at this point, not going to make a team.
Right.
There to just please God anything show up. And he's going to take it out on the mound after all this. I figure the guy's crazy. I think he's just trying to do anything to make an excuse for something. After all this, Peavy, who also had a really tough game, walks over to the umpires after he leaves, after he's out after whatever it was, four innings, three innings, something like that. And I've never seen this before, ever. Peavy talks to the umpires. The umpires talk to the grounds crew real briefly. And after the game, while I'm doing the post game, The grounds crew goes out and tears down the entire mound and rebuilds it. And all I could think to myself was, son of a gun, Matt Latos was right. He was right. Or, there was clearly something off with the mound.
Or Peavy was covering for him or something. How could you start a game
and have
something that severe
spring
actually
training
exist?
That's all I can think of. It's a spring training game. That's all I could think of. Matt Latos, the kind of guy who's worried about the mound. Shohei Ohtani worried about I'm worried about Shohei Ohtani and his not pitching. I know you heard in Joe's updates that it's likely that he's out for the rest of the season and maybe even next year, too.
Sucks.
It does suck, and here's how much. 114 at-bats, and the guy was hitting 289, 372, 535. Six home runs, half as many strikeouts, walks as strikeouts with a pretty decent ratio, 15 walks, 33 strikeouts. Pitching-wise, he'd started 9 games, threw almost 50 innings, a 3.1 ERA, over 11 strikeouts per 9, a 131 ERA plus, a 3.2 FIP. This guy, I mean, he was doing it.
Yep.
He was doing the very thing that no one thought he could do to the level.
But it's possible it contributed to his issue.
Maybe.
And there was a hypothesis as to this idea of doing everything and why and how it could contribute.
It's possible. But listen, you've got to look at the athlete. You've got to admire the athleticism. You've got to admire the skill sets. And to be quite honest with you, I understand that the guy himself is going to take a long time to get back from surgery, and hopefully Tommy John is what it has come to be. It's, you know, pop it in, everything's good to go, you're back to being the guy you were. I'm not all that convinced that because of his success and because of the way baseball rosters are being shaped now, that we don't see, maybe it's relievers instead of starters, but we don't see teams really start to look at two-way players in a much more real and meaningful way because of the crunch that you've got. I'm not altogether convinced that teams are going to wave this off as an injury concern as fast as they used to.
We talked to Dana White on Friday to preview UFC 225. Part of it was Chicago's own CM Punk trying to be an actual fighter instead of a pretend fighter. Well, he actually got his ass kicked again, and he was turned into a piece of hamburger. And stayed in the match, but all that did was allow himself to be pummeled by Mike Jackson. A unanimous decision loss, and this was Dana White's comment afterward. Listen, he got clipped a lot in that fight. Looked like he was hurt bad a couple times. He stayed in there. He went for 3 rounds. It should be a wrap. Guy's 39 years old. I love the guy. Nicest guy in the world. We gave him 2 shots, and he had a lot of heart in this fight. And yeah, I think he should call it a wrap. That means it's a wrap.
Yes, it is. When Dana White says so, you're done.
When Dana has said that, I think he's telling you what the deal is. I want to get into that, which you said about Shohei Ohtani.
Sure.
And this idea about what it might mean about the two-way player. Conclusions we don't want to draw. Conclusions it might be fair to draw. We're going to do that. This segment brought to you by Timeshare Exit Team. Make this year the last year you get fed up trying to book your timeshare. If it no longer fits in your lifestyle, go to timeshareexitteam.com and discover your options for a safe, permanent exit. TimeshareExitTeam.com. There are some undiscussed reasons that are the headwinds for a two-way player and how to keep a two-way player healthy, because the Ohtani thing, it just sucks. Sucks for baseball. It was an incredible story leading up to the All-Star game, and now they're not going to have that, and we're not going to have him to watch for a year and a half. So it's too bad. Bernstein and McKnight, lot to come on The Score. You haven't got your tickets yet for a week from today. You should. 670thescore.com/ondeck. That's going to get you information and an opportunity to purchase tickets for the Cubs On Deck Luncheon. Our very first one going to be at Budweiser Brickhouse Tavern at Wrigley Field on June 18th. Javier Baez and Ian Happ will be guests of this show. Also, a programming note regarding today. Told that McNeil and Parkins at 2 o'clock today will be joined by Kansas City Chiefs coach Andy Reid.
Be a good conversation.
Yeah, there's some content there. There are some connections with Matt Nagy and the offense that he is putting together.
Probably worth noting that Andy Reid enthusiast Terry Boris joins us at noon.
Yes, Terry is going to talk about the Belmont.
Andy Reid. We're not asking about Andy Reid
and
the punt, pass, and kick championship he won?
And
that was Andrew Reid. Totally different.
That's right.
Andrew.
It was indeed Andrew Reid. I'm looking at an article here that Will Carroll wrote. If you follow Will Carroll, he's at Injury Expert on Twitter, and he works with the people at Motus, M-O-T-U-S. And you've heard that Motus is a research company, a technology company that has the sleeves that are designed to measure arm stress. And Theo Epstein has mentioned Motus before as they chase the holy grail of injury prediction. Is what they're trying to be on the forefront of. This is one of the first companies to try to do that.
And prevention to a certain amount, but prediction for
right,
sure.
Prediction to then facilitate prevention. And they have several studies here that I'm not going to get into about the specifics of it, called acute to chronic ratio, or ACR, based on pitching frequencies, when certain pitches are thrown, what's done on off days, what's done in games, high stress pitches. And the question is, who broke Shohei Ohtani? And saying, is it possible that this could have been prevented? Their data believes the answer is yes.
Really?
Ohtani came to MLB out of the Japanese system. While Japanese starters tend to throw roughly once a week, they also do extensive throwing programs and tend to go deeper into games. Ohtani was a two-way player in Japan as well. Mm-hmm. So his usage patterns were unique there, as well as how the Angels attempted to manage his workload. We've seen in many cases that Japanese pitchers do not adjust well to the changes imposed on them by the American system. Daisuke Matsuzaka, Masahiro Tanaka, and Yu Darvish have all had elbow issues despite some success in the U.S. both before and after the injury. And this was mentioned before when he came up. He said, why you're just comparing him to Japanese pitchers? For a lot of reasons, because of, say, pitchers in that league. It's not the fact that they happen to be Japanese. It's the fact that they came up through and were pitching in that particular Japanese major league.
Not to mention what happens in high school at Japanese tournaments. I mean, there is a tradition of one kid throwing hundreds and hundreds of pitches over a weekend, over four different starts. I mean, that's... I don't know if that's mentioned in this, but Matsuzaka for sure, Ohtani, I believe, and I think Darvish, but all of them were used. There's a term for the kid that does this, for the elite high school teams, for the pitcher that ends up throwing the 600 pitchers or so. I can't pronounce it, nor would I even try, but that they were all that guy. They were all that kid through that tournament, and that, you know, you look back at things like Daniel Hudson and him throwing at Old Dominion and the number of pitches he threw as a 19, 20-year-old too. I mean, that's got to be taken into account to this.
Here's the question. With everything that we know, and remember, one of the biggest differences in the two leagues is travel, simply because of the area involved. Japan is a small island, and all of their professional teams are there. They are not making 4 or 5 hour flights. They are, and what baseball has tried to do to fix some of these circadian rhythm travel issues, we know about sleep, about nutrition. The question that Joe Sheehan and other people have asked about Ohtani, the two-way player now, is rest. How you define rest, how you define downtime, what you expect, what's a reasonable expectation for a professional athlete's body, whether it's this ligament or whether it is the effect that something has elsewhere, somewhere as we go through the kinetic chain, that pitchers need downtime. They need to not be playing baseball. Starting pitchers.
Well,
and relief pitchers after a certain usage, it's understood. Mm-hmm. And the question being, whatever you're asking him to do, to get up and swing a bat around, who knows what the – if we haven't looked at the effect of other baseball movements or other just levels of physical activity taking away from what should be full-on rest and recovery time that's reasonable for a pitcher.
Yeah, it's difficult to – it's difficult for teams, I guess, to shy away from, or difficult for teams to not take advantage of every little thing they've got on that roster, though. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they had an opportunity, and Shohei Ohtani was more than willing to take it, of having a player that can do two things for you, and at that level. As baseball evolves, you know, hopefully we get more information on these injuries and more information on what kind of rest is necessitated. I don't know. Maybe what do you figure changes first? If we decide more and more, and if the information shows more and more that starting pitchers just can't be allowed to do, you know, X, Y, and Z, that they need this kind of rest in order to be effective, doesn't that in and of itself scream for a designated hitter in all
yes,
leagues?
Yes, 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 and yes. And like you said during transition, this idea, if you celebrate the quirk of the double switch,
yeah,
then you have to celebrate feeling the need to pull your effective starter in a high leverage situation in the fifth.
Yeah, with guys on first and third and in a one-run game.
And you have to say, well, that's National League Baseball and I love it. You can't have one without the other. You can't.
It'd be very difficult to, and the argument you'd have to make to support it would be a tough one. I think you're right. I think to a certain degree, if you're going to keep playing the way the National League is playing, you're going to find a bigger and bigger disadvantage if this information, if this research continues to bear out what it's borne out so far. And I don't know, you know, how many young kids are, well, I shouldn't say kids, but prospects, you know, guys who have actually been drafted are still playing two ways that were drafted to, you know, to be two-way players. I'm talking about Hunter Green and others, you know, who were drafted not at the top of the draft. But, you know, you talk to a guy like Nick Hostetler who runs the draft for the White Sox, or even McLeod who runs it for the Cubs. There are more and more players, athletes, who seem to have, at least in the last couple of drafts, seem to have the ability to do both. And I don't know if we're getting to a point in the young training, in the specialization of sport or whatever, where, you know, it's a natural curve, you know, a natural place on the curve, rather, to see more of those athletes at this point. But I would be surprised if teams, regardless of the research here that we're pointing out with the MOTUS and stuff, if teams weren't interested in trying to take advantage of all the skills they can on a roster, especially in the National League, where you're forced to crunch like that.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying about maximizing the value, you know, adding up bits of wins above replacement over the course of a year, adding up bits of runs prevented and runs scored from everybody on your roster. When John Lester pinch hits, when Jason Marquis used to pinch run, when you find ways to use these guys, I agree with you. But I think that's different than really thinking you're going to have guys who are available to do something all the time. Because I don't think with MLB travel schedules, you're just able to have healthy guys that way.
Yeah, I mean, if this points to the rest and the sleep being that much more important than we'd realized before, then yeah, I mean, there could be just a natural human barrier to being able to be active that often.
I love the idea of what you're saying, because we're hearing it in all sports, the idea of lack of positions. You can see when great hockey teams play, when all of a sudden a defenseman becomes forward one just because of where he is in the cycle and where he's gotten with the puck, and then somebody else drops back and essentially becomes a defenseman. Great hockey is positionless. Great basketball is positionless. We see all kinds of amorphous football defenses and jack-of-all-trades Swiss Army knife offensive players used and finding value. Baseball is just everything you're saying makes sense, but at some point you just run into things where you're dealing with a human being that with a body that can only do so much over 6 months.
You look at rosters, though, especially in the National League and the way they're constructed. We've seen, you know, this Cubs team has been one to try and eke out as much defensive value as you can from play. I mean, look at Javi Baez, look at Chris Bryant, who can easily go into the outfield. Even Ian Happ is a player who is, you know, probably forced to the outfield a little bit. The Pirates are trying, God bless their souls, trying to teach Josh Bell how to play first base. It's happening, I guess. You have to find ways to find defensive versatility. You have to find ways to teach defensive versatility. In order to do that, you've got to draft the athletes able to perform multiple roles. I mean, even the way, and I know this is a little bit backwards to, you know, backing up into what we're talking about, but the way Anthony Rizzo is able to be deployed on bunt defense, like Keith Hernandez was, I mean, that he's listed as a second baseman in a lot of fantasy leagues, which I know doesn't matter here, but because he shifts to play that position, it gives you more defensive versatility. Not that that matters to Joe Maddon at all, but to have a guy who's able to do that athletically changes it. It's a weapon. It's a weapon that you're able to use.
Talking baseball on The Score. This is brought to you by the Chicago Wolves. The Wolves are making big plans for their 25th anniversary. Get your season tickets now and receive exclusive benefits. Visit ChicagoWolves.com or call 1-800-THE-WOLVES. Greg Gabriel of Pro Football Weekly and 670 The Score. I believe I saw him wandering around.
Really?
And he published something.
Call him in here.
He published something today that claims the Bears are the most talented they have been in 9 years. Most talented since 2010.
It's a long damn time.
So he's seen things that he likes enough. We'll find out what he means when he joins us in studio next on The Score. This segment's brought to you by Fogo de Chão. Savor authentic Brazilian steakhouse flavors at Fogo de Chão, even on a busy schedule during weekday lunch. Visit their locations in Chicago, Rosemont, and Naperville for lunch, starting at $15. Greg Gabriel works here at 670 The Score and for Pro Football Weekly. And the former Bears scouting director had some optimistic thoughts about the talent level of this Bears roster. Greg's in studio with us on Bernstein and McKnight. What's happening, man? How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
You're doing well, and I think a Bears fan's eyebrows will raise and say, what does Greg Gabriel see that he likes?
Well, obviously, there's holes, and there's holes on every team in the National Football League. But I think when you look at the overall makeup of the roster, I think it's in pretty good shape. Could they use another edge rusher? Yeah. Could he already be here? Yeah. We're not going to find some of that stuff out because, you know, during the offseason program, OTAs, mini camp, there's no contact. So as far as offensive and defensive linemen, you're not finding a lot about those guys other than are they doing their assignments correctly. You know, you can get a lot from the receivers, defensive backs, linebackers, as far as, you know, 7-on-7, that type of thing. But just, you know, going to mini camp last week and seeing, you know, an OT, I like the makeup of the roster. I like the way the guys were practicing.
What did you like about it?
The enthusiasm. The way, even though you're unsure about yourselves because you're going through a new offense, I think if you want to use a comparison, you can say the Rams last year. Now, the Rams went out and won the division. I'm not going to say the Bears are going to win this division. The NFC West was not a strong division. It was almost like a perfect situation for the Rams last year. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they improved when they brought in Sean McVay. You got a similar situation. Matt Nagy is here this year. You've got a second-year quarterback. You're hoping that he makes a jump. And you brought in some receivers with, you know, that was the weak point of the roster last year with Allen Robinson and Taylor Gabriel and the tight end. So I think that, you know, it looks good on paper. I like the way they practiced. I like what I saw in practice. Whether they got to stay healthy, that's a big key. They haven't been healthy for 3 years in a row. They've just about led the league in injuries. I think if you know, the tea leaves fall the way they should, then it's going to be a much improved football team. Are they going to compete for a playoff spot? I don't know that yet. I think it's way too early to tell.
How much are you able to divine, I guess, from the OTAs and Mitchell Trubisky's work? Like, is that how much can he play into, or does he play into, your idea that this is one of the most talented rosters they've had in a few years?
Well, I think without a doubt it's the most talented roster they have, but is that saying a lot?
Right.
You know, as compared to what? You know, this team has been down as far as talent, you know, going back. I mean, when we were here with Jerry Angelo and myself, we're here, I think we had a talented roster, and I'm not taking anything away, but, you know, it went downhill for a while. When Phil came in and you lost some good players, you weren't replacing them. We drafted 12 all-pro players in that time we were here, in the 10-year period we were here, and that makes for a good roster. It that hasn't been the case in the 8 years since we left, or 7 years since we left.
Is this offense one that is going to ask the offensive line to be as important as another offense might? And I know Andy Reid's going to be on at 2:00. Maybe it's a good question for him sort of philosophically. But, you know, we always think about the Mike Martz, the 7-step drops, and what the edges of that offensive line have to do to keep the quarterback safe. With the RPOs, with 3-step drops, with half-field reads, Does that help you avoid having to have a leak-proof line?
Well, the ability for the quarterback to get the ball out of his hand more quickly helps the offensive line, and the offensive line, you know, not having to block for 3 seconds for maybe a second and a half, or so, that makes everybody better. So it's just the way the scheme is devised to get the ball out of the quarterback's hand quickly, that's going to help the line. And then you bring in Harry Hiestand, who I worked with Harry for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years here. I know what kind of coach he is. He's, even when he left, he showed what he could do down at Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. He had a bunch of first-round picks, and he developed those guys. He's going to make these guys that much better. I think if you talk to people like Olin Krutz, you know, the makeup, the player makeup isn't that bad. It's you know, is it the best line in the league? No, but the talent level's a little better than people have given it credit for, and I think part of that was the design. It was poorly designed offense the last few years.
You mentioned the defensive line and how you could probably use another pass rusher on this roster on paper as it stands now. A lot of people have pointed to perhaps Roy Robertson-Harris or perhaps Aaron Lynch that could step up and make some sort of moves in that
Isaiah
pass.
Isaiah Irving.
Sure, guys yeah. who can move and maybe rush the passer. If Vic Fangio doesn't get kind of a breakout season, for lack of a better term, from some of these guys, what's he going to have to do, in your estimation, Greg, to get a pass rush that can be dangerous?
Well, then you've got a scheme, do different types of blitz packages or whatever to create some pressure. But I think when you look at the defensive line, it's going to be, I think, a little bit more athletic. Mitch Unrein's gone. So you're going to have Roy Robertson-Harris and who's the other guy we
the
got?
The Lynch guy?
No. Lynch is playing outside linebacker.
Outside linebacker. He may run at the quarter.
Right. Now, when you get into you're playing 65% of the time, you're playing in your sub packages, he may not have his hand in the dirt, but he's going to be a pass rusher. Now, and he's an interesting guy because, he started his college career at Notre Dame. As a freshman, I think he had 5.5 sacks. He's like 17 and 18 years old. He was a young freshman. And he looked like, he had the potential to be a first-round pick 3-4 years down the road. Well, he had some off-field issues. His head wasn't screwed on right. He leaves Notre Dame after 1 year. He transfers to South Florida. That's where he's from. Has to sit out a year. Then he plays there 1 year. Didn't have a great year. And then enters the draft. I think he went in the 5th or 6th round. Under Fangio, he played good football. That first year in the league, I think he had 6 sacks or something, 6.5 sacks as a rookie coming off the bench. He is a very talented guy. I think, all the stars got to align for us to say that, he is going to be a guy that can be a difference maker on this defense. I can't say that right now. Nobody can say that. Nobody at Hallis Hall can say that, but he has got the talent to be a pretty good player.
Who else flashed at OTAs? I think a good scout goes there and forgets it, doesn't even want to see the names and just judge the action and then figure out which guy just did what you saw him do. Is there anybody who you said, okay, I may change my mind about this guy, maybe have a new thought about this guy, whether a rookie or a veteran?
Well, the one guy is we were talking about off the air was Kevin White. And only because, as we saw the first 3 years here, obviously injuries played into it. Here's a guy who was, 6'2 or 6'3, 215 pounds and runs a 4.35, but he looked like a 4.6 guy or a 4.65 guy on the field. Wasn't sure of himself. I think part of that had to do with the offense he played in at West Virginia. Very small route tree, and then he comes into a more complex system. You have to make sight adjustments and things, and when you're not sure of yourself, you don't play fast. I think a lot of that, the injuries and the unsurety played into that. He just seemed to be playing like last week with more confidence in himself. And you saw the 4.35 speed. You saw the athleticism. Now, whether that's going to translate to on the play good or on the field good play come training camp in another 5 weeks, another 6 weeks, that remains to be seen. But I think you could say going into camp, the arrow's going up, but who knows if it's going to continue going up.
That's still terrific news. I mean, if you get one Bears fan thinking that Kevin White is something contributing to success, that's something other than just this horrible feeling of a complete zero. We've changed the bar for what his expectations are. If he can help a little bit and be in a rotation of receivers, that's all good.
Yeah, I mean, anything now is a bonus after the first 3 years. So you're hoping for something. Even if he's not a starter, if he's your fourth receiver but still gets 20, 25 catches and can make a couple big plays because of his rare athleticism, that makes the team that much better. A guy that kind of jumped out, and can't tell much from offensive linemen in minicamps and OTAs, but and I wanted to watch him going in because he was a defensive lineman as a free agent rookie last year, was Rashad Coward, who played at Virginia Union or Old Dominion, one of those schools in Virginia. But he's a big guy, 6'6". He's 320. He's got long arms. He was pretty athletic. Well, they moved him over to the offensive side. And he was playing right tackle. And you look
big
at
Big Cat Williams, right?
Yes. Well, that's one of the, he's a better athlete than Big Cat, though. And so you watch him move around, and you go, Perry might have something here. Now it's a big block of clay, and he's got to mold that. And it might not be ready this year, but you know, when you get a player like that, you're not looking this year. You're looking down the road. And is this somebody that can become a player if everything comes together correctly?
Going, stand on the offensive side of the ball then. Are there ways within Matt Nagy's offense, the way we kind of conceive of it, that Jordan Howard and Tariq Cohen are on the field together? Or is Taylor Gabriel as a slot type receiver, although he says he can do more than that, does he kind of negate Cohen on the field with Howard, if that makes any sense?
I think a good offensive coach finds a way to get playmakers on the field at the same time.
Sure.
So I don't, and then you go back to Atlanta, and Taylor Gabriel played outside a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't strictly an inside guy. He probably played outside more than he played inside. And so you have that versatility there. And then the way that Tariq Cohen can catch the ball, and then you look at the different formations that Matt Nagy is going to use. And, yeah, you can see a situation where Cohen is used as a slot receiver and Howard's in the backfield. And then, you know, kind of like, you know, the little guy at Kansas City last year, how they used him, you know, because Cohen, not quite as tall, but the same type of player.
Tyreek Hill?
Yes. Yeah. Same type of explosive player.
Now, you mentioned the different formations. That, as it was explained to me, that when it's really working at its best, you're lined up the same way every time, not giving a cue to the defense. So when this thing's really humming, they can run multiple variable pattern groupings and looks out of the very same formation, so you don't give an indication to the defense pre-snap. But that takes time to build there, that they're not quite there yet. And they maybe don't know their personnel in quite the same way yet, and they don't have Travis Kelce, so who was the guy off of which a lot of that was built. So how long does that take?
Well, you know, if you go back to, and Alex Smith said it took him a few years to really feel comfortable within this scheme. So you're going to do what you can at this time. You don't want to put this team on overload and then they end up playing slow. You got to build it. It's not going to be 100% of this offense. I cannot see being installed in this first year.
That's why I ask, because I always make the joke in basketball, because anytime you get a new basketball coach who comes in, he's got this big playbook and he wants to run all this stuff. And by the third game, they're down to three plays. Maybe they get two inbounds plays that they can run, and then they've got a base system. But he only knows. But everybody gets all excited as you're putting it all in. But does it take actual game action to know where to pair back? Do they know in practice, or is that the purpose of exhibition games to learn some of these things?
Well, I don't think you're going to see a whole lot. You're going to see it more in practice than you are in the exhibition games. I think that's what's going to give the Bears an advantage in the first couple games of the season. Green Bay is going to go back and look at Kansas City and Philly tape, because that's pretty much the same offense, and try to figure out what the Bears are going to do based on what those teams did. You're going to see pure vanilla during the preseason. Why show anything more than that? That's the competitive advantage that you have in those first couple games, is there's not going to be very much on tape.
And they've got the five exhibition games too, right? They added the extra one because
of
Hall of Fame games. So
that's
you better like vanilla. Anyway, Greg, thank you. We're glad you could
stop
in.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you joining us. Greg Gabriel of The Score and Pro Football Weekly. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about what's going on with the Triple Crown winner, Justify, regarding the lack of buzz, regarding the actual race. Was there any skullduggery going on with the Bob Baffert stable? No less a horse racing expert than Terry Bors is going to be our guest next on Bernstein and McKnight on The Score.